from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Today, we hear from newly appointed CEO of Jericho Row Community Health Center, Dr. Alana Krolinkowski, as she sits down with BTPM NPR's reporter, Alex Simone. Then we speak with Niagara Pride as they celebrate their fifth anniversary. Later, What's Next contributor Nayla Ansari-Cotillo previews Storytelling with Courage, a panel and workshop for nonprofits taking place this Friday, October 17th. She talks with several of the participants involved in the event. But first, last Thursday, outside of their 1100 Main Street building, workers and patients at the Kaleida Health Family Planning Clinic held a press conference. Kaleida plans to close the facility later this year. Speakers expressed concern over the impact of the closure, citing recent Medicaid cuts from the One Big Beautiful Bill, racial disparity in maternal health, and raising STI and STD rates. Among those who spoke was New York State Senator April Baskins.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you to the community members, to the media, and to my elected colleagues who are joining us here today. Thank you to CWA and all of our organized labor who are leading on this issue. A lot of times we identify our organized labor and our bargaining unions as advocates specifically in the space for workers' rights, which we do need across this country. But on this particular issue, their passion and their drive is around the residents of this community, of our region, who will be out of decent humanity without health care. And for that, I am eternally grateful to you all. Thank you for your sacrifice. Thank you for your hard work. And thank you for being the people who really put people first. God bless you. You know, for your leadership and your passion, always speaking out on this issue, and to the great assemblymen, my colleague in government, John Rivera, and our Common Council Majority Leader, Leah Halton Pope, thank you all too for fighting for this community. Dr. Lipford said something that was very, very profound when she said the communities impacted first by these cuts. The communities impacted first. When are we gonna talk about that first? Okay, one block away, not even a block, you could just step across the street a couple steps and you're gonna be in the heart of the Fruit Belt community, a historically black community here in the city of Buffalo, who I honestly today send my condolences. That is a community of homeowners, of grandmothers, of children, of educators, of civil servants, of residents, our neighbors, who year after year after year have government and big business making decisions about what happens in their backyard. And they are the ones who are impacted first at all times. They never ever really get that first conversation or that first knock on the door, that first seat at the table. Correct me if I'm wrong, council member. But you're always pushing, we're always pushing to make sure that those residents have a voice about the decisions that are being made in this surrounding area. And here we are today. You think anybody knocked on their doors and asked them if this was the closest clinic to keep their hearts beating, to keep them feeling alive, to keep their children healthy? I don't think anybody probably knocked one door. We could go over there right now, news cameras and all, and asked, did you have a say in if a clinic, a healthcare clinic, that is just steps away from your home should be removed from your community? The first to be impacted, like the doctor said. When I first started in local government as an elected official, you all know I started in county government. At the onset of 2019, I was 1 year into being a county legislator, and the county did this cancer study, and they found that there was a cancer cluster in Erie County. You know where the height of that cancer cluster was? the black community. Years after that, we were faced with COVID-19 pandemic, uptick in the 14215 zip code. Where is that zip code? The historically black community. Year after that, domestic terrorist decides that he wants to get in his car, drive to a community and terrorize black people. 10 lives robbed from us, 13 wounded. Just who was the first impacted? Our community. Your words ring strong, doctor. The first impacted. We don't want to talk about that. 6 months after the mass shooting, one of our most deadliest blizzards in recent history hits Buffalo, New York. 51% of the victims, people of color. First impacted, our community. Our community is sick and tired of being the first impacted, the first on the chopping block, and the first to go. And the congressman said it so eloquently, and I know he could say it so more viciously, but he's a gentleman, but I'll do it for him. Those of you that identify with being loyal to your political party over decent humanity, you are going to feel this too. You may not be historically the first impacted, but this time around, you will feel it. And no one will care who you vote for on election day or what color you represent or what party you align with. Your grandmother, your children, and the people in your family who you know damn well are on social services too. People who look like you, your neighbors, not everybody in your family, can afford to have health clinics robbed. It's coming to you too. The time is now to put this pettiness and this silliness that is bleeding out of Washington aside. And I believe that organized labor and the residents of Buffalo, New York, can be the first to be the trendsetters in this country to reverse it. We do not want this clinic shut down. Thank you all.
Thank you, Senator Baskin.
The clinic is expected to see its last patients on November 24th, with the facility scheduled to close December 7th. This Wednesday, Niagara Pride is celebrating its fifth anniversary at the Keenan Center. Jay Moran sits down with President and co-founder Ronald Pinachesny and co-executive director Sherry Fawcett to discuss the celebration, community engagement, and their mission to create safe, affirming spaces for marginalized populations.
Right off the bat, I mean, you guys have been on a couple of times with us already here. What struck me is that coming up on Wednesday, you're going to be celebrating your fifth anniversary. I can't believe it's only 5 years.
I know. Some days it feels a little bit longer.
I say that because I feel like you're so entrenched.
So I think having a history in the community and just having had our respective experiences with different organizations, we feel like we've been in the community 20 plus years, but Niagara Pride itself as an agency has only been incorporated for 5 years.
So an anniversary event.
Exactly.
This coming Wednesday at the Keenan Center in Lockport.
Correct.
Is this the first time you're having an anniversary event, or you've been?
Yes.
So we're breaking the ice here a little bit. Yeah.
Yes. October 15th, we actually incorporated. Actually, on that day, I was going back through our historical papers, and that's when we received our official recognition as a nonprofit. Was October 15th, 2020. So the timing works out beautifully this year.
Was it planned that way, though?
No, it was just...
It's just a date we picked, seriously.
Right,
it
was the not availability planned. Of the...
Oh, okay.
The Keenan Center. Yes.
Oh, okay. Exactly. So, but we were at least looking to do something in October to kick off what would then be our fifth anniversary year. So starting October 25, going through September 26, a lot of folks, if you go on our website, if you look at our programming materials, you'll see that we've updated our logo to reflect our fifth anniversary year, and we're looking to do a couple extra pieces here and there for each of our events throughout the year to commemorate that this is our fifth year in existence. So the 5K will have a special element in 26. Our Pride Festivals will have a little something to, again, honor our 5 years in existence. And so that'll be the theme for the next 12 months.
So before we get into a couple of the particulars of the event to talk about, just what have you guys learned in 5 years of running an organization like this?
Well, for me, I've been with Niagara Pride for 3 years.
Okay.
I've learned that you have to listen to the community if you want to be successful.
Mm.
You know, take what they say to heart. You know, if they say you should maybe bring in, I don't know, more drag queens, or maybe you need to do more community outreaches, listen to them, because their advice made us successful, I feel, by listening.
I would have to say the exact same thing. The community, no matter whatever ideas Sherry and I may have, or the other board members may have, whenever you try to implement something and it doesn't line up with the community's needs and wants at that moment in time, it may be a great idea on paper. It may be a great event at some point down the road, but you're not going to be able to bring in the community and really service their needs if you're not listening to what they're saying that they want.
Oh, let's look at what's going to be on paper then for Wednesday at the Keenan Center. So what is in store?
So we're going to have part of our efforts. If folks know Niagara Pride, they know that we are a donation-based nonprofit. We don't have any grant funding other than small little grants or sponsorships, but we don't have any federal or state funding that supports us. So donations are huge, and so we're going to have a silent auction that's going to have a Buffalo sports package, a couple signed items, a Dalton Kincaid helmet. We have
Don't give it all away.
Well, people want to know what they're going to be bidding on, potentially. Exactly. He's no longer with the Sabres, but Dylan Cozens. We have a signed hockey stick from him. We have a couple other like Bandits items. And so we're going to have a really nice Buffalo sports package. Sure. We have a New York Giants, a couple autographed items, but even though we're the only New York team, but that's okay.
Right.
we won't fault them. And no, some other really nice items, some high-end gift cards and stuff.
A wine wall kind of thing.
So like I think one of the items will have like 11 bottles of wine in it, so there's definitely stuff
there's a variety of things for everybody.
But yep, so we'll do that, and then we'll also have an opportunity for folks to talk to all of the board members, reminisce about what the last 5 years has really been for the organization, where we came from, where we are today, what we're looking for in the future, where we're going, and just really have that opportunity to meet with folks that have been impacted by our services. We'll have clients, consumers attending. We'll have some former board members present and people in the community that have been instrumental in our success. So it'll be a nice group of people to really celebrate the achievements of Niagara Pride as an agency.
And Sherry, you as a military individual have great experience in putting these types of things together. Is everything in line and ready to go? And what about the food?
Everything is ready to go. Actually, it's all staged and lined up. If you said pull the trigger now, I'd say, okay, let's go.
Okay.
We're having light fare, little mini pizzas, shrimp shooters,
meatball sliders, the wine. Don't forget, we'll have glasses of wine. A lot of people are.
And hopefully can pull off I'd like to do a champagne toast. That to me is very important because our theme is bubbles.
Okay.
And so to me that a champagne toast would be nice. And we're also going to have a beautiful cake to celebrate Niagara Pride.
Jericho Road Community Health Center has a new CEO, Dr. Alana Kurlikowski, a Western New York native. Dr. Kurlikowski's connection to Jericho Road began nearly two decades ago as she first walked through the doors as an intern. She went on to practice full spectrum family medicine, served as the organization's chief medical officer, and now prepares to lead into its next chapter.
You're new to being a CEO, right? What is it like, especially being promoted internally, right? Going from that experience of being a part of Jericho Road to now being really the one leading Jericho Road.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on and for taking the time today. We definitely appreciate that. It's really humbling. Dr. Glick and Joyce, they started Jericho Road in 1997 and started with three patients the first week. And today we have an over $40 million budget. We take care of more than 24,000 patients a year. We take care of patients in three other countries, and it's just a really large operation. And it's very humbling to be able to step into this role. And I've really appreciated the outpouring of love and support from our staff and from the community over the last number of weeks leading up to taking over this position.
And especially that experience, right, to really make it from the starting position, right, of being an intern and over many years to gain that experience, right? What's it like to maybe look back and see where you started and like where you are now and maybe to grow along with Jericho Road itself?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I was in college at the University of Buffalo, and a friend of mine saw a newspaper article about Jericho Road. She said, "This looks like a place that would interest you." And so I called up and asked if I could do an internship. And I'll be forever grateful that they said yes. That was the summer of 2005. 2 years later, during a leave of absence from medical school, as I was really trying to figure out if medicine was the right path for me, I worked in the front office for 6 months and definitely have some understanding of what that means to work on all different levels of the organization. A number of years later, I came back and did my family medicine rotation during medical school with Dr. Glick and the other physicians. It was really during that time that I came to understand that family medicine was really what my path would be. And I really feel passionate about building relationships with patients, families, and communities. I left Buffalo to go do residency in Massachusetts at a community health center. After that, lived in Malawi for a year, working at a district hospital in Mangochi, in a rural part of Malawi, and then came back 10 years ago as a physician. I've moved into different leadership roles throughout that time and have been the chief medical officer for the last 6 years before moving into this role. We have a lot of really incredible people within the organization that are so committed to the work that we do, and I'm really grateful to be moving into this role to work with them to advance our mission.
And especially, like you said, having that experience of living in a few different countries, and what has maybe that done to change your approach, you know, and the value of those experiences of living in a few other countries?
I have a lot of passion for language and culture. It was really those passions that made me question whether medicine was the right path. Right after my summer at Jericho Road in 2005, I studied abroad in Mexico and really loved being immersed in the language and the culture. Came back and said, should I go to medical school? Not quite sure. I decided to still go, but it was that summer after my first year of medical school, spending time in rural Tanzania, living with a family, being immersed in the culture, and learning a little Swahili, working on a public health project that really made me question whether it was the right path. But I ended up going back to medical school. Fast forward, I said I lived in Malawi for a year. And, you know, absolutely, I just have a lot of interest in all different people, languages, cultures, and that's what we do at Jericho Road. We take care of people from all over the world. I've learned a lot about cross-cultural leadership and working with people across cultures. And what I've come to realize, and I hope that, you know, we can all maybe get to a point where we see this, that we have shared humanity, that there are so many ways in which we are alike, more ways that we're alike than we are different.
And it also sounds like that experience then, whether it's in Malawi or in Ghana or in Mexico, right, that really kind of proves valuable now, like you said, that cross-cultural aspect of you know, since Jericho Road works with so many people who are not originally from the U.S.,
Yes, for sure. A couple examples. One would be in my role as a physician and being able to connect with people from all over the world. I speak Spanish in enough of a capacity to be able to do all my visits in Spanish. Swahili, not so much, but I can communicate with patients in Swahili. And you can see when you even say a few words in someone else's language, how they relax and how you can connect with them in a different way. So that's one piece. The other side is the global health work that we do in Sierra Leone, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nepal. And our chief compliance and global health officer, Fidel Menavanza, tells me it's time for me to start going to some of our countries and travel and see those places. But because I lived in Malawi, I have a better understanding of the work that we're doing abroad.
And again, when you look at, like you're saying, it sounds like that really ties in well with the legacy and the impact of Dr. Myron Glick as well. And, you know, it sounds like you guys are really working to have that legacy even grow beyond just the borders of the U.S.
Yes, for sure. Dr. Glick has been a fearless, committed leader who has always been committed to the most vulnerable and living out the gospel. And we're a faith-based organization, living out our faith, loving your neighbor. And the movement into other countries was really this idea of following our friends home. And we've gone to places and built health facilities in places where people had come from as refugees many years ago. So that's why we're in Sierra Leone, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nepal. Those are places where we have seen refugees come from those countries over the years. And the global health work, I know in particular, is something that Dr. Glick is very passionate about.
And along those lines, now that you are the one heading the organization, you know, could you maybe go a little bit into I guess continuing that and how you plan to continue the innovation and, you know, continuing that the community's trust and, you know, deepening those bonds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my goal is for Jericho Road to be a global model of holistic, community-rooted, mission-driven healthcare that honors the dignity of every person and builds equity in our communities. We did a billboard campaign earlier this year. Maybe some people will remember the big orange billboards that were all around about loving your neighbor. And when people look at Jericho Road and when they experience our care, I want them to see what it means to love your neighbor through compassion and excellence and justice. And it's really important for me that our community knows that everyone is welcome. We are well known for our care of refugees and immigrants, but Jericho Road's open to everyone, and we are, you know, very interested in building more trust across all communities, American-born Black and Brown communities in Buffalo. A number of years ago, our director of population health showed me some data that even our Native American patients have worse health disparities. And so we welcome conversation with leaders in these communities to say, how can Jericho Road be a home for all patients in the community?
And in terms of the five-year plan, right? You know, I mean, a five-year plan, I feel like, is something that is a very commonly used term in this day and age. But with the national, the federal sort of healthcare and, you know, federal funding being what it is, right? Does that maybe change the focus on maybe how far out, you know, does it become a two-year plan or a one-year plan instead of 5 years?
A little bit. I do think, you know, our mission is that we care for our communities and advocate for systemic health equity to demonstrate the unconditional love of Jesus. And, you know, our five-year plan is that we continue demonstrating, we advance our mission and we continue loving our neighbor. And I don't know that I can tell you exactly what Jericho Road will look like in 5 years. I can tell you that there are concerns about the impacts of HR1 and what that looks like for community health centers like Jericho Road. For sure, I've told our board and I told staff yesterday that our focus areas are systems, you know, improving our systems, making sure that, you know, our systems enable us to deliver care with excellence, ensuring that the resources entrusted to us deliver life and hope to our community, and that we are facing changing front funding streams. It's still not exactly clear what that will look like. You know, come January 1st, the New York State is going to receive less federal funding for Medicaid. How they choose then to implement that and what that looks like for community health centers is still not 100% known. The Community Health Center Association of New York State has estimated that health centers will lose 11% of our revenue based on the provisions of HR1. And health centers across New York State, there's around 80 health centers across the state of New York, operate on a 1% to 2% margin. Like, we can't lose 11% of our revenue. So absolutely trying to be creative, and how can we be, you know, how can we have operational excellence, ensure financial sustainability while continuing to advance our mission and care for the community the way we want to?
Right. So does that maybe also place, I guess, a greater emphasis on things like, you know, fundraising campaigns, donors, and, you know, or state funding, that kind of thing, you know, those different measures?
Yes, absolutely. We just last week had our annual fundraiser, Bridging the Gap, and we'll be securing the date soon for next year. So I encourage everyone listening to come and join us next year. But I just had this conversation yesterday with our director of advancement that, yes, we will be having to look more closely at fundraising. I think for all nonprofits, the challenge is with less federal funding in general, that means everyone is competing for the same foundation money. Everyone's trying to compete for the same grants. And so we will be having to look at more corporate donors and philanthropic giving, and absolutely fundraising is going to be important.
I feel like the flip side is, does that come with maybe increased flexibility at all? You know, the fact that it's like, well, if you're not, maybe if you were to be using less state or federal money, then it's like, well, you can, you know, I feel like grants always have a little bit of an asterisk, right? It has to be used this way specifically or something like that.
Potentially. You know, for example, our global work, we can't use any federal funds for anyway. It's always been that way. And so there's not really an impact in that regard. The biggest part of what we do is providing primary care. And it's hard to ask people for money to care for patients when really people think that their insurance should be paying for that. Well, if our uninsured rate goes up, we're then providing basically free care because we don't get any additional funding for patients without insurance. We have a sliding fee scale. We are required to care for anyone regardless of their ability to pay. And we'll continue to do that. But it's interesting. I don't know how much flexibility there really is on the provision of medical care side.
Okay. And I was at an event actually recently for another organization where they mentioned concerns with not just food deserts in East Buffalo, but also in, you know, even around Buffalo, you know, throughout Buffalo, but also healthcare deserts, right? And as a, you know, a community healthcare org such as yourself, like, how much is that something where you're like looking at that every day? Like, hey, okay, there is, like, again, there is a healthcare desert, you know, a lack of maybe available care to these communities, and really trying to find a way to consistently make that care more accessible.
Yes, a few things in that regard. So one, I was just having a conversation with some of our staff yesterday about, you know, what's the average number of visits that we do per patient and how could we increase access to the community? So absolutely primary care access is something that's on our minds that I know is hugely important for health, the health of people in this country. Recently, I was at the Igniting Hope Conference and I was on the panel for that. Buffalo Center for Health Equity is focusing on five areas: housing, food insecurity, workforce, literacy, and primary care access. And I know they're currently working on a strategic plan, and forthcoming will be work groups in those five areas. And again, would encourage anyone listening to stay tuned and potentially get engaged if any of those areas are of interest to you. We will definitely be involved in the primary care access side. There's a lot of factors systemically in the healthcare system as a whole that really undervalue primary care. Primary care investment is very low. Like when you look at the total cost of healthcare in this country and you look at the spending that goes to primary care, it's 3-4%. And if you look over at Oregon, Oregon a number of years ago passed a law that 12% of their healthcare spend has to go to primary care. And they slowly went up year over year, but they've reached that 12%. And we know that countries that invest more in primary care have better health outcomes and save money. So obviously at Jericho Road, we're faith-driven. We believe in the moral side of this argument, but I know that not everyone does. But there's definitely a health outcome side to this and financial, that we know that the cost of healthcare in this country is rising. If you are running a business, you will see that your health insurance premiums are going up again. And 2/3 of bankruptcies in this country are due to medical bills. So we have a real crisis in the healthcare space in this country. And we feel the impacts of that at Jericho Road as you try to figure out how to increase primary care access for the community.
Earlier, you mentioned, specifically Dr. Joanne Hefner with Neighborhood Health. And I just want to, along those lines, sort of key in on the face of healthcare leadership, right? And the fact that leadership roles, right, are, you know, maybe an increasing number of women in leadership roles in healthcare, right? And maybe how that could change messaging, perhaps, you know, whether it is like other people looking to get into the medical field themselves and maybe seeing you as figures to emulate, or whether that's just, you know, a sign of changing times overall and, you know, positive change. Like, could you, maybe give some thoughts on that?
Sure. I believe that we've had women in leadership in various spaces. Definitely, when I came back 10 years ago, Lavan Ansari was overseeing, she's the CEO of Community Health Center Buffalo, Joanne Hefner, the CEO of Neighborhood Health Center, and they're still in these roles 10 years later. And so, yes, Dr. Glick has been, he was the founder, of course, and then there was a period of time we had a different CEO, and then he became the CEO. And so this is the first female leader for Jericho Road. But I think we need all people to be examples, men, women, all different skin tones, everyone, to give the example of what could be, right? So it's important that we have mentors, we have coaches, we have sponsors, we have people who can show us that path. Last week at our Bridging the Gap event, our annual fundraiser, my 8-year-old daughter really wanted to come. And when I got up to speak, I was looking at the whole room of everyone gathered, but multiple people were looking over at her, and she was so excited and had the video up to watch and to take record of that. And it's really encouraging. You can encourage young people, and then you can also encourage people who are along the path, and they can see themselves in that position in the future.
This Friday at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, we will host Storytelling with Courage, a panel and workshop for nonprofits. What's Next contributor, Naila Ansari-Cotillo, speaks with participant Dina Thompson, Executive Director of Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, Jomo Okoto, Vice President of the Juneteenth Festival, and panel moderator Akua Menze-Du, President of Clementine Go Group, and also What's Next contributor. Together, they explore how stories can inspire action, build trust, and connect communities.
Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, where we talk about what's happening now and what's next in the ongoing pursuit of equity, truth, and community healing. Today's episode is all about the power of storytelling, which will be truth-telling when you all hear all the panelists that we have here today, not just as an art, but as an action. I'm joined with three incredible leaders who are shaping the landscape of leadership, creativity, and courage in Western New York. I have Akua Menze-Du, president of Clementine Gold Group and moderator for this upcoming Storytelling with Courage panel for nonprofits through Story Growing Western New York.
Yes.
I got all that in.
That's awesome.
I have Dina Thompson, who will be here from the Executive Director of Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition. Yes. I got all tongue twisters today. And the legend that everyone knows is Jomo Okoro, who's the Vice President of the Juneteenth Festival, and so much more, by the way, but we'll use that as your tag title name today.
That's why I play today.
That's what you played today. So we have an exciting event happening October 17th that will actually be here at Buffalo Toronto Media from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. with Story Growing Western New York. And you all are presenting an amazing panel on storytelling, particularly for nonprofits. So can we talk a little bit about Story Growing Western New York? And then we'll kind of go into dive deep into what you all are going to be doing. So Dina, I'm gonna put you on because you are a story girl. You're a vet in this.
So thank you so much. Thank you for having me here to be able to promote Story Growing, but also talk about the experience that I've had with Story Growing. I am the executive director of Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, but I'm also a founding member. And so it is out of passion for my community and the need that was in our community about looking at the disproportionality of our young people and our adults entering into punitive systems and a lack of resources that were around to prevent them from going into those systems. So out of that passion, Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition was started. We are 10 years old.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. So we're 10 years old. But as we grew in the 10 years, servicing the community became a high demand, but we were not highly noted within the community. So we did not have a lot of the resources that would promote the work that we were doing. And so Story Growing came along and it helped us to build up our presence within the community, connect with other nonprofit and for-profit organizations that were in the community. But it gave us a voice and a way to lift our voice within the community and lift our work within the community. So it gave us this public-facing way to tell not only our story, but tell the story of the people that we were servicing and able to increase our partnerships about people who wanted to partner with us on this mission of addressing people who wanted second chances.
And that's so important. So often I feel like with nonprofits, people just assume because they do a program, they understand the entire story of what the organization does and what it means to the community. So Akil, I'm going to put you on with this panel that is going to be happening October 17th. You're moderating and it's entitled Storytelling with Courage. Can you talk a little bit about why storytelling is something that we need to have courage to do, particularly in this time now?
Yeah. And so I know folks probably are aware of some of the backdrops that are kind of happening right now in the context of our society, but then also within the administration, going after conversations around DEI, things that we can say, we can't say. And I think there's a lot of nonprofits who are navigating their mission and, you know, the drive to the work that they're doing on a regular basis. But how do you do that and tell that larger story and reach certain populations when it's actively under attack? I know on the panel, we're going to talk about Story Growing with courage, with truth behind it, but doing it in ways that allow you to really assert your mission, but then also, you know, understand the backdrop in terms of what's happening. So from our standpoint, I think we're going to frame it in a way that we think about the past and how folks have done this, because this is not new.
Right.
A lot of folks, you know, it's our journey and it's our fight currently, but it's not new. And so how do we look to the past to help us look to the future and what needs to happen?
Because we've been fighting before DEI was established, right?
Exactly.
So I'm going to go to you, Jomo, because we, you know, we chatted before we went on air and, you know, we talked about truth telling. And why is truth telling important now as opposed to fear and people being afraid to say what they feel like they should be saying when they're telling their stories?
Without standing on the truth, you're bullied into accepting a narrative. And if you don't have the proper information, if you don't have the courage, it's easier to go with the flow, especially in a bully society. Whether it's right or wrong, it's usually easier to go with the flow. Unless knowledge or your spirit convicts you to dig a little deeper. As a community, as organizations, as we're talking about telling stories, you know, lest we forget, we will get drawn into the flow of wrong. And just because it's loud and it has might, it does not mean that it's right. Mm-hmm. And many of us have been primed with recognition of truth. So it's hard for us to ignore it, even if we feel uncomfortable. And that's about 405 years of Africans in America trying to be resistant to systems that are wrong and loud. Mm-hmm. Being able to tell the story gives other people a chance who might be on the wrong side of truth. It might give them a chance to learn and just reassess how do we move forward. As she was talking, I'm hearing Sankofa, Sankofa, yep. Sankofa, mm-hmm. which means go back. Fetch and return, which is instructing the people that it's not wrong to go back to the past and look to the future and walk in it triumphantly. But we have another challenge because we have an administration that is trying to stop public media, trying to stop information. It wants people to not speak the truth, and it's trying its best to cast a spell so that people stay asleep and not woke. Your spirit and your consciousness has to be your guide, even if you close your eyes right now. We're going to have to go a little deeper. This is not new, but knowing what people did to get them through the valley mm-hmm. or over the mountain, we're going to have to dig deeper than what's being said.
Absolutely. And I think, Dina, because you're an alum of Story Growing, mm-hmm. I think we all don't necessarily always know how we can grow our organizations to really tell those stories. Can you speak? Because you 10 years in the game is no joke. I mean, JOMO's been doing, you know, the biggest Juneteenth. I'll shout that out. in the country. But, Dina, could you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah. So it is our stories that connect us, right? Like, it humanizes us. It also shows us that how we are more alike than we are different, right? And so it's so powerful to be able to share your story. Like we're saying, like we learn from the past and we take those valuable lessons that we learn from the past, we plant those seeds, and then we begin to grow them, right? And I think that's exactly what Story Growing gives you an opportunity to do, is to learn from other people, take that knowledge, plant it in your organization, and then begin to grow it. So our reach has not only reached across Western New York, which is where our goal was, but we're now presenting in Chicago and Ohio. And so we are touching other places with programmings that we've developed right here in Western New York. But these are these other hard lessons that we get to not only look externally, but internally. And so some of those things that when we begin to look at the things that need to happen at the past, we also need to look at past history, because there's a healing process that also needs to happen, like a healing process in the way we work with each other, a healing process that needs to happen in the laws that were established that prohibit us. Like right now, our language is being policed. Mm-hmm. So it really prevents us from doing the most active or best work that we can do. So I feel like being able to tell our story, we can collectively come together. We can collectively build the communities that we all want to live, play, work, and thrive in. And I think that's what Story Growing does. It gives you the tools and connectivity to be able to tell those stories. It is really, really important for us not to let people steal your story mm-hmm. or misrepresent your story, and to be able to grow in an avenue and learn different ways to tell your story is really, really important. So some people are great with social media. Some people are great with telling your story orally. Some people are great with writing your story. What you learn from Story Growing is to find out, like, where is an area that you really excel in? Some mm-hmm. people are great in artistry, right? Taking photography. And it shows you how to grow in areas that you would like to grow, but also learn a new skill set, connect with that new skill set, and then be able to offer some of the things that you have learned to other people too.
Absolutely. I have a question that I want all of you to answer. So, you know, whoever's last kind of gets a little bit more time to think about this. But when you each think of the phrase, drive meaningful change on your own terms, what does that look like in a world for nonprofits?
Can I start?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think what it means is, one, you're going to have to stand up. And if you're driving, whatever kind of vehicle it is, you have to sit properly, stand properly, or lean properly. But you have to know what kind of vehicle you have and how does that vehicle navigate different terrain. If you're on a boat, you're going to have to understand tides. You may have to understand wind. If you're driving a vehicle, you have to know if it's smooth ground. Is it gravel? Is it blacktop? Is it sand? And I think that we're going to have to use our wisdom to navigate over paths that might change. But also, we're not going to get away from Sankofa. There's certain African things you're just not going to get right. away from. Uh-huh. And we're going to have to be able to draw from the past. We're going to have to be able to go deep, and wherever that depth gives you truth, you're going to have to touch it. And usually, and I just want to squeeze this in, then stop me fast. But
good.
What we have to do is realize that in our history and culture, in particular as African people, our arts are the truth. Mm-hmm. There are some cultures that said, huh, you guys didn't write anything down. You weren't literate. No, just because we didn't write it down, it don't mean that we didn't know it. You didn't know it because you didn't know the language. And I will take a little bit of authority, me being one of the persons who control your movements as a drummer. Mm-hmm. Our mm-hmm. arts, our history, our culture, our music has our story. Mm-hmm. And the more we tap into our arts, our culture, and those who can speak and spread the truth, we use music, song, even just the alliteration to a song. You can sing the words, you can respond. If I don't even, you know, say what the title of the song is. That's because culturally we have a stamp on our DNA. We have a stamp on our consciousness, and artists, musicians, priests, or whoever can conjure that up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the institutions have to make way for that to come out. That's mm-hmm. what I meant. That's the yeah. answer to the mm-hmm. question.
so good, right? So
I know Jomo is giving us all the word today. The gems.
But I feel like the part I want to rest on, it's a movement. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a movement. And I think that people are stuck and not thinking that this is a movement. And so we need to unstick ourselves and think like we are in the vehicle and we are moving and we need to envision the destination. So this is the destination. And what do we need to get to the destination? And right, to your point, like what vehicle do we need to get to this destination? But I think when you say that, this is a road trip like you take with your family. You ain't going by yourself. Right, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we got people in this car with us that's going to help us get to the destination. So this movement is that this is what we have to think about. This is a constant motion, is a collaborative motion. And then we just need to self-identify, like, here's the destination that we want. And back to the Sankofa, like, what do we put in the car? Mm-hmm. Or what do we put in the vehicle to get there? And I think a lot of the tools that we're learning about in this story growing is that we're putting these tools in the car with us. We're packing our luggage with us and we're getting to this destination to tell these stories because these stories are important. I feel like Horton hears a who. We are here. We are here. We are here. And we are telling our story because we are here. And to your point, it doesn't have to be written down because we are the story. We are the story.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and they've said it a lot already, right, in terms of, you know, how we think about this. I think that nonprofits are really at a specific crux, right, because they protect the truth, you know what I mean? Like, from a public standpoint, they're telling larger stories, they know the data, they're closer to a lot of the issues that are happening in community. And at a time like this, where it's being challenged to even speak up, I think that's the position that nonprofits have to navigate, right? Because on one end, you know the story, you know what's happening on the ground, you're closer to the issues than maybe most of the public. But at the same time, if you can't tell that story, then what, right? And so I think from a standpoint of like owning that, I think we have to think about different ways that we start to tell that story. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, we know that race and gender are being really targeted right now. Mm-hmm. So how do you tell that story without necessarily naming certain things, right? I think that makes it difficult, but folks are finding their way through that. Mm-hmm. They're reframing language. Maybe you're talking about economics, you're talking about zip codes. And we kind of started to talk about that before we had the conversation. It still removes a lot of power when you can't say what it is that you mean to say. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is just going to be a time right now where you have to navigate on paper what you have to do, but underground, the conversations that are happening still need to be happening, right?
I think to that point, too, is just recognizing the power when we talk about nonprofits. $350 billion is what nonprofits brings to New York State. 1.4 million people are employed in nonprofits. That's power that we have. And so I think we have to also remember that in this movement.
Mm-hmm, because, you know, a lot of folks, we don't like to talk for some reason. Nonprofit always just seems like it's community and, everybody's not broke. And
I say that. Right, exactly.
That's right.
And, you know, to that point is how do we get some of these larger institutions and nonprofits to make sure that they're not fearful and have courage to help those of us that are really on the ground that have to really function without fear? Yeah. We never really had a choice to function in fear, period. But how do we get some of those organizations to step up outside of just the idea of being an ally?
Well, I think that the stories that we tell, and we have this strange power that we're overlooked, but we're also the driving force of everyone's movement. And I'm saying that to say people might not like certain people in the 60s. We don't like black people, but everybody was listening to our music. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, they were doing the dances that, you know, we were doing 10 years before, which mean that it was in them, but they didn't really want to acknowledge it. And the more they listened, the more they heard, the more they felt, something even in their minds humanized us enough to let us in their mouth and in their hearts. And I think that telling stories, person to person, organization to organization, people in the streets, it allow everyday people to say, wait a minute, they really want the same things we want. And I might have to challenge the prejudices or the loud noise that's not really touching my heart. I just talked to this young lady and what she want for her family is the same thing I want for my family. I know that drum and dance and art, it made you a very loving person. It honed in discipline. It made you scientific, mathematical, social thinking, able to be an educator, able to be an administrator. Maybe if these people had access to the same resources, the noise that we hear as a problem can be preempted by giving the resources early. We spend a lot of money post-incarceration, post this, post that. And it's easier, you know, it's cheaper instead of sending like thousands and thousands of local troops to a city. It might be easier to fund the nonprofits and create community activities that educate and give people the proper history and education and inspiration to stand on. And don't underestimate the craftiness of African people, because the drums were made illegal, but we never lost the beat, even if we had to change the instrumentation.
Jazz.
Tap. Washboards, buckets, foot stumping, canes stamping in church. So the beat was never lost, but the drum was made illegal. We found a way to keep the rhythm.
Absolutely. You know, I do want to touch upon this notion sometimes of the tradition of the nonprofit that lives in a very specific type of world. And I've been around where you have, you know, new brown, you know, nonprofits that are Black and brown, and they're like, well, you're not doing it this way. Like, this is the way that the system tells you that you have to do it. And that doesn't necessarily always serve us. Is there a world where we can recreate what nonprofits look like, particularly for our communities? It's like, yes, you have your due diligence because there's the governmental things of taxes and all of those, you know, kind of inroads into it. But in terms of like applications, grants, how do you get funded? Because you get some people that get funded that just write really well, but don't do any of the actual programming. And then you have some folks, like I can think of like aunts and uncles I have in a community that's just doing stuff in their basement and really doing a lot of great work, that don't get that funding. How do we navigate that world?
I think that shift is starting to happen. And I can think of a couple of our clients even who we've navigated through some of those changes, where instead of all written, because I think of like a lot of dominant cultural norms that, you know, we're forced to, you know, exist in, right? And so there's organizations now who, instead of doing all this writing for these grant proposals, are now doing video recording, right? So you're able to tell your story. They're thinking about accessibility even, right? So like, is there ways that we can tell our story through a video, or, you know, there's a site visit that somebody's going to come on board and be able to visit. But I think some of those shifts are starting to happen. More people need to think about that, right? Because grants, from the beginning of the time, it's always like this written, the written word, right? Like what you can put down, but that doesn't correlate to the getting out to the community and connecting to folks that you're trying to serve. So there's always been kind of that rift in that world. But I think that more folks are trying to expand that and trying to get in a position where it's not just one way or the other, right? Like they're more open in terms of how you are able to do that.
Yeah. And I think challenging folks to see the storytelling in real life.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a lot of ways that people can kind of fumble what they're doing. But when you really see, there's like, oh no, you know, this may not have been the best application in the world, but I know they do what they say they do. So let's figure out how to help and navigate that. We're, you know, getting ready to close out our episode here. And I wanted to have you all give another opportunity from each of you for our listeners, especially ones that are leading, you know, nonprofit organizations as a whole, you know, even small businesses, grassroots work. What's one step that they can take to begin their storytelling with courage and clarity?
I think trying to come to this event, because because one of the things that is going to definitely be necessary is how to be creative to work together. And I think that the more people see that in a time like this, it's empowering, and empowering gives you courage and hope.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. We have a collective power, you know. I think of three strands wound together cannot be broken, right? And so I feel like even coming and listening and connecting acknowledges that we're not alone. And so being part of Story Growing, I think, is a first step. And so I would encourage people to come and listen.
And I would just say, you know, center community voices. At the end of the day, it's harder to shift a story that centers lived experience and people at the heart of it than it is like a general institutional message. And so a lot of nonprofits are trying to navigate what that storytelling looks like for them. But as long as you continue to center the community, I think that'll be a great start for anybody that's trying to be strong in this time.
Absolutely. All right. Last question. Why Story Grow in Western New York?
This is the vehicle that's going to allow us to get to the next page, and encouraging other organizations and people to really come together and share. That's the key to moving forward. We're not going to win alone.
And I would, for myself, I say knowledge is power. The more I know, the better I do. And so come and gather the knowledge so that you can begin to create and move with power accuracy, and collaboration.
And it's free, y'all.
It's free.
No cost to attend. So come out and join us in this conversation.
But everyone has to come to the free kickoff.
Gotta come to the free kickoff.
So that you can, you know, for the program, it's a full year and the sessions start in January. So October 17th is going to be here at the Buffalo Toronto Public Media. It goes from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Make sure you all go there.
That's all for this episode of What's Next. Be sure to tune in Wednesday for Jennifer Rizzo's full conversation with Jay Moran. This has been What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.